Deb Nichols is a senior clinician and social worker specialising in child protection, trauma, mental health and nervous system regulation. Deb has a keen interest in the neuroscience of mental health, especially the effects of the nervous system, and is married to her soulmate Fletcher of 20 years, two adult sons, and has lived in WA for 4 years after relocating from New Zealand. At the moment, Deb is contracted senior therapist for Southwest Wellbeing and in the midst of writing corporate trainings around mental health and the nervous system. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So today we're talking all about habits and the brain. So how did you get started? Like, was it something that you were always passionate about, or was it something that you fell into?
It kind of was something I fell into. I was always really interested in how people decided things, how they got to the point they were in their lives once they were adults. So I was kind of a mature student when I started social work in my early 30s. Mm. And the first placement I got as a social worker was under a manager who'd actually written a lot of government programs around trauma and children specifically. So that's really where I got into the neuroscience of children, from especially from the ages of 0 to 3, and the impacts of experiences around those ages that have on them as adults.
How fascinating. And I think it's so important at that age that we are able to look at it and then learn from it as well, so that when we are adults, we can kind of see the different perspectives and what they can offer us.
That's right. Carol.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, so how do habits form in the brain, or what part of the brain is it that form habits?
That's not a lot. That's probably the biggest complex question, because there's so many parts.
I like to start.
There's so many parts that, and what it really, from my perspective, what it comes down to is, as babies and young children, our brain develops from the bottom up. So when we're first in utero, our base brain, or the limbic system, is very alive, which is your everything to do with your heartbeat and your temperature, and that's where fight, flight and freeze come from. But as you grow in those first 3 years, all the levels of the brain are depending on the experiences that you have with your caregivers. That's how they all link together. So the health of all the neurotransmitters, neural pathways, your sort of dopamine uptake is all sort of categorized around those experiences, probably mostly first 3 years, but then the bigger picture, first 7 years.
So it sounds like, like a lot of our habits then are based on external factors.
A huge amount as well. Like, there's external, and then there's, of course, biology. There is the inherited types of conditions, like neuroconditions, that can happen. Mm. There's lots and lots of studies around the mental health conditions, such as schizophrenia and bipolar and ADHD, because they're all involved in the workings of habit forming parts of the brain. That's, I think that's why it's so complex, because our brains are not cookie cutters. They sort of can be studied as a cookie cutter, but they really aren't. Especially when you have adverse childhood experiences versus, whatever healthy, normal experiences that you get. For instance, the amount of eye contact and facial contact you get with your parents in your first 3 years actually awakens lots of neurotransmitters and pathways.
Wow.
So if you have neglect in that way, then those neurotransmitters don't actually come online.
And so then that would play a really big role with that next generation, that a lot of them are in childcare because we've got two parent families working.
Yes, huge. There was a study done by one of our New Zealand neuroscientists and neuroclinicians, though he wasn't a neuroscientist, and it was a longitudinal study around the eldest girl in the family, and the around about 60-something percent of the eldest girls ended up having a higher qualification, tertiary, and earning more, because the eldest child got a lot more of the attention.
Right.
because of a lot more one-on-one attention, lots more neurotransmitters, lots more neural pathways, lots more healthy sort of reactions in that way. So that was pretty incredible one to read, actually.
Mm. And so can you explain the concept of neural pathways and how they relate to habit forming?
So that's a really easy way that I love to talk to clients about, is that it's like a lot of us in WA are familiar with four-wheel driving, and it's very similar to a four-wheel drive track.
Okay.
So a lot of those habit-forming things we learn as children, biologically in as humans, is around sort of the dopamine effects of different things. So for instance, if you are learning as a child that you're not going to be touching something hot, there's going to be a negative effect. So that kind of forces our choosing to be something that's not negative, if you get what I mean. So that's forming a habit of kind of a negative kind of result from touching something you're not supposed to. But as we grow up, the neural pathways through life, people that we see, watch, people that we hang around, the culture that we're in, form the neural pathways like four-wheel drive tracks. So you're going along a four-wheel drive track and it's kind of easy-ish, but if you try and go off it, it's very hard.
Oh, that's such a great example.
Yeah, so that's around the same thing with habits. Our brain is very clever at conserving energy. So things like habit formings that we do when we're young, like which foot do you put first in your pair of pants? That's a habit.
Oh.
And we don't actually realise that our brain doesn't even think about it.
It's just hardwired.
Because it's conserving. Yeah, it's conserving energy. So the more you try and put towards forming a new habit, the more energy it's going to take for our brain. Our brain doesn't like that. It'll always try and go back, hence the four-wheel drive track. So when I'm sort of talking to clients around new habits to do with their, a lot of the clients that I see are very, very activated nervous systems.
Mm.
And a lot of our nervous systems are actually habitually in high alert. And it's the new habits of trialing little things that create a peaceful or a dopamine effect.
So when we're in that, when we're in that high state that you mentioned, is it possible to form new habits, or do we need to alter those levels first so that we're able to then be at a more neutral level before we can form new habits?
I believe that you do. It usually, like if you think of addictions, and I work in a support some people in rehab at the moment, so I go in once a week to talk with them, and the only reason that they are changing their habits because they hit rock bottom. And they hit a place where there was almost a dorsal vagal kind of response, which means it's very low energy, very low. They have no activation. It's very like hypo-activated instead of hyper.
What are some things that you can do? And I'm sort of going a little bit off topic here, but what are some things that you can do to improve that so that then you're able to then work on those new habits?
Really, it comes down to connection with people who are safe. It really comes down to if the nervous system feels safe enough to actually choose something. So if you're not feeling safe enough, like deep down, your nervous system won't choose it. It will go from it.
I think that can be really hard when you've been in that trauma situation to kind of work out in your own mind who is that safe person that you can trust to then get that connection.
Exactly. When I do work with the ones at the rehab, and it is a little bit different than working with my private clients, because a lot of my private clients, their nervous systems are very activated, so they're coming in very highly emotional. And then when I'm working with the ones in the rehab who have already decided to stop and to abstain, it's a lot easier for them to actually try some of the things, some of the strategies we talk about. And some of them are very simple, like lying on grass and going out under a tree, connecting with the soil and really slowing down their mornings. It's been a big key. Then the ones I have privately who are unable to stop because they're still trying to function in life. So,
wow.
Complex.
It is. And I guess on that note, so then how do our brains work out the difference between the good habits and the bad habits? You know, when you're talking about, like, you know, drug addiction or alcohol or, you know, other addictions.
Yeah. Addictions are really, again, very complex. There is a lot of material evidence out there around adverse experiences in childhood correlating to addictions and childhood trauma and all that sort of thing. But to notice the difference between bad or good habits when you're in that space is something the brain is, all it's doing is searching very hard for safety in any way, shape or form. That's what it's wanting to do. So the choosing is based on what is going to feel safe right at this moment. So a habit of meth use or cocaine or heroin or any of those higher end drugs, there's a very quick fix to what they perceive as safety. Quick one.
So if you
and then the come down even, is like, oh.
Yeah, but even if you know that there are potential overdoses, I guess if you are so used to being in that pattern, then it is safe for you.
Mm.
That's a really tricky one. And so how does the brain then adapt to changes in routine?
That's comes back to the four-wheel drive analogy. It's really tough to adapt to change. It's actual using, your brain uses a lot of energy in that space because it's forward thinking. It is using a lot of that prefrontal cortex, executive function. And if that has been not so much damaged, but if it's been the development of that had been marred by anything, biological or external, can be very, very hard to change your habits. And that's where a lot of, I suppose, relapse comes in, or even just like normal overeating or undereating or being addicted to exercise. Yeah, it all comes in there. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
it does.
I feel
like I'm going on and on.
You mentioned dopamine before. So what impact does that have, like a neurotransmitter, have on habit forming?
Pretty big, actually. Dopamine is involved in, I think, pretty much everywhere in the brain. But if there's a place that there it's inhibited or it's unable to transmute, that's where you get lots of... So, for instance, if it's unable to transmute properly, you do get, that's what they find in ADHD and schizophrenia and other kinds of quite severe mental health. But I suppose the dopamine part of it is, they say it's a pleasure hormone or a pleasure neurotransmitter, but it's more around like, I'm just trying to think what I was thinking about before. It's more around the motivation. Is it a positive motivation or a negative motivation? So, for instance, I don't know if you have heard of the cold plunges that people are getting into now. Yeah. So that's a lot of mental energy to get to that point. But the cold plunges almost reset dopamine and serotonin. And so people get addicted to it because of the rush of dopamine that comes in afterwards.
Oh.
So it's almost like, and that's where the drugs come in as a whole. If you have a huge amount of rush of dopamine, which is unnatural, that's where you get the addiction type behaviours. But if you have that one where they're doing through the Wim Hof sort of strategies that they teach, is that it's a dopamine rush that's natural. It's naturally created by your own body. And that's where they're seeing the health benefits and mental clarity and motivation and better feelings of, I don't know, health and vitality. So there's a bit of science going on there. I think a lot of research happening around that now.
So is it then that you need to do to get the dopamine level to get the motivation to continue doing? Is that the way I'm understanding it?
Again, goes back to the complexity of safety, of feelings of So the feelings that you get from safety come from your autonomic nervous system, which is directly resulted from the health of your neurotransmitters, the health of your dopamine and serotonin uptake. And it's, it can be diet, it can be environment, it can be stress or external stresses. So it's really one of those complex questions, I think.
And so if you're, say, homeless or you have addictions, you probably have a harder time than getting those nutrients and getting, you know, the food that you need, then I imagine then it would be even harder to get yourself on the right path to change those habits, because your body's not getting the nutrients to feed your brain.
Yeah, that's pretty much a very big part of it. I used to run a community hub in my hometown in New Zealand, and one of our main our real main ethos was around connecting with our chronic homeless community, because it was so big over there. It's been big over there for about 10 years.
Really?
It's huge. It's like when I moved over here, there was nothing compared to home. But we used to really provide a safe, well, this is what we try to do, provide a safe place that they could come without judgment. So we had showers and we had clothes and we would sit there and have cuppas with them and just really make an effort to be, for them to be supported in the space. And it took about, like, I was there for 3 years, and I'd say a good majority of them really felt safe, and they would ask their mental health nurses, because a lot of them had injections for different mental health conditions, they would come into our space because that's where they felt safe. But some of the different decisions they would make around their money started changing, because we started supporting them with food, and it wasn't so much giving them a handout, it was a hand up. So we would charge them $10 for a week for a whole, like, a parcel of food that they wanted to choose. And they would start prioritizing $10 a week, whereas before it would go to alcohol.
Yeah.
So, but it sounds all came about through connection.
Yeah, and it sounds like it took quite a period of time, though, to get those results.
Yes, very long time. Because they're in themselves, they are a family.
Yes.
And so we had chronic homeless and situational homeless over there around what we're seeing here now, the rental crisis. But our chronic homeless, we would get them to a point where we would secure some housing or some kind of option, but it would only last a very small amount of time because they were alone and lonely, and they craved the connection, habit connection of their own friends and the people they felt comfortable with. So the choosing of being in a home rather than being with people they trusted was a bigger motivation.
And I'm going off on a slightly different track here, but I know that, you know, when I used to work with homeless kids with mental illness and drug and alcohol issues, we had mandalas and we'd have, you know, colouring in pencils there, and it was not to, you know, minimise or, you know, in a childlike way, you know, their age or anything along those lines. But it's because that repetitive action of colouring in can help to alleviate stress in the brain. So
sure does.
I'm really interested, like, you know, you've mentioned connection, but also about mindfulness and meditation and what ways that can affect the neural circuits related to habits.
From my own, I suppose, view, or just watching some of my clients for the last few years, is that type of meditation, and it's really a slowing down and relaxing of the nervous system, and that allows a lot more positive chemicals to flow. Because if you think about rushing, think about being in a kind of high alert arena that a lot of homeless community are in most of the time, there's no real space in that nervous system for peace and calm. So there's a rush going on in the brain, and the cortisol that comes in to keep you on high alert prevents some of the other chemicals coming in that can help with almost, what am I trying to say, choosing things that are better for you, really. Mindful choosing, I suppose, or mindful actions. So if you're able to create a bit of slow down or a bit of safety and peace, especially with the repetitive stuff, that can really calm down the nervous system. That's all this big cycle determining whether we feel safe or not. Not even like we don't even have to say, oh, I feel safe. Our actual nervous system feeling safe or not. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think it's quite a big area as far as trying to get that nervous system to slow down and get that, you know, go back to that neutral zone.
Hugely. I've got lots of very not high-end clients. They're clients that are in high-pressure work environments.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much corporate, but just like I've got a lot of mining clients here. I've got clients who are supervising in the mining industry, and the amount of pressure that comes on that type of role, safety-wise, and, you know, you're looking after a lot of people's lives, or you've got a lot of people relying on your skill, that in itself activates the nervous system in a way that's productive. But if you have that all the time for years, I've got several of them like that now, they're finding they can't find joy in anything because they're so fried, and their nervous system's so used to running very, very quickly.
So what,
and we're seeing a lot of that.
What would be maybe like the top five things that you would, you know, connection included, give to your clients as sort of little homework, I guess, to help change those habits and to start forming new habits?
The top five things, one of them would be for ones that aren't at the point of breaking down, I sort of talk to them about what their interests are, what things that really float their, like what they really find joy out of.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are different. One of them is a keen mountain biker. And
oh,
I'm
wow.
going, okay, we, and he hadn't done it for so long. So we chatted about, okay, this is one of your missions for the week, is to get out twice, put on music in your head, in your ears, being on the mountain, always just has to have one on. And then come back, and I want you to tell me exactly what you noticed in your body afterwards. And I was actually, instead of doing it mindlessly, you're doing it mindfully. So it's real mindful slowing down. You're actually noticing what your body's doing. Are you breathing slower? Are you finding your thoughts are more calmer? That sort of thing. The other thing I do is a nervous system protocol, which is for my ones that are really so strung out they can't even think. And it's usually in conjunction with support from family members. It is most definitely time off their work. This is for my like real acute.
Absolutely.
And it's an actual reset. So it's allowing their nervous system enough time to come down enough so we can work on maintaining a little bit more calm.
And then you're getting that connection with family as well.
Yes.
So it's a bonus. Yep.
I usually bring family in. A lot of mine have actually been older teenagers, and that's very common because of the structure of the brain that's happening in those years. And having that buy-in from the family, it causes a bit of relax for the teen to be able to actually do what they need to do to bring them their nervous system back down again. Yes, it's quite comes back to what is their motivation to actually, like, I usually ask them, what are your goals here? Because if your goal is for me to fix this arena, then I'm not going to be able to do that until your nervous system is supported and you actually do the work. So I do get to that point with them.
And then
I can send them away with strategies, but if they are unable to choose them, and that usually comes back again to what we're talking about, and what's their motivation. And a lot of them are so strung out, they do trial a few things. I don't give them too many things.
No, but there needs to be an accountability in there as well.
Yeah.
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 Absolutely.
Because they just come for an hour a week or an hour every 2 weeks, but I'm really impressed with the strength of some people and what they've come through.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Especially when they. I had one young girl who had a lot of stuff going on for her, lots, and some biological and some not. But she trialed one thing, and it was basically just, so we had a nervous system protocol in for her and for her family to support. And it was, she's a type of nervous system that just needs peace and space from people, because she's very, very sensitive to everyone else's. And it was basically just swimming in her pool with no one interrupting for as long as she needed. And she came back and said how much her brain slowed down because she wasn't worried about people interrupting or asking her things, or she just could just be. And that was really important for her. So I was really proud of her doing that, because that's huge.
Oh, that's incredible. And I think, you know, some people are people persons and some people aren't.
Some people aren't. That's right.
That's important. We are coming to the end. Comes around really quickly. Is there anything else that you would like to add in relation to habit forming? Or
I think habit forming is probably it's one of the top things that everybody struggles with.
It is.
It's habit forming and it's breaking them. So I think having an understanding and actually bringing yourself to a point where, what do I want? What do I want with my life? Actually being honest about that, and even seeking support on how to get there, because it can really help with just getting a few little tweaks. It does go a long way.
Okay, well, how can people reach out to you if they'd like to find out more?
So I am contracting through Southwest Wellbeing Centre in Bunbury.
Mm-hmm.
That is the perfect place to get hold of me. I'm just going to grab up the actual contact. I'm sorry, I should have got that.
That's okay. Is there a Facebook page for the...
Yes, there is a Facebook page for Southwest Wellbeing Centre at the moment, as well as a website, but we're on 08 9791 9955, and a lot of us there have lots of experience in that arena.
Well, fantastic. Thank you, Deb Nichols, and
no worries.
Look forward to having you again sometime.
Thank you so much.